seat. We are going to get started. We're so glad that you are here this evening. My name is Justin. We're delighted that you're here. We've got some space. If we need to create some space, we can go further up the steps, but y'all are good where you are. Find a seat around the room. Again, my name is Justin. This is my friend Brian. We're glad that you are at TOT. We still need to bring, it's been a long time, I completely forgot about the tater tots.
Right.
We're gonna roast some tots and bring them
at some point. Could have brought some from Germany.
And that would be, they'd probably do, yeah. I had enough potatoes in Germany, actually. Well, if this is your first time, welcome. You'll see these little sheets of paper that I was trying to pass around the room last minute. These are important because on the top you can scan a QR code to ask any question whatsoever. The second half of our time this evening will be devoted to Brian and I trying to answer as many questions as we can possibly get through. And I think John's gonna kind of moderate those questions. So when you see questions on there, if you scan that QR code, like the ones that you would like asked, and those will hopefully go up to the top, or pose a question yourself, that would be great. Also, you can join our email list by scanning that QR code on the bottom left. Couple things that I want to bring your attention to. Here are the dates. We had an extra week off due to our schedules. Normally we're every other week, but it's been 3 weeks since y'all were last together.
Yes.
That was great. You had the bishop join
yes.
you.
So much fun.
I heard it was awesome. And we have every other week pretty much for the rest of the summer from this day on. So we're good. And there's two exciting things. One of them is on here. One of them is not on here. I don't have the poll. If you're in the Holy City Life group, which is a fellowship group that folks who've come to this Theology on Tuesdays, they were like, we should meet more frequently than every other Tuesday. So they were like, we're going to do some fellowship opportunities for young adults outside of this time. Thus, we created the Holy City Life group. Victoria, if you would raise your hand, she's kind of putting on that.
Queen Victoria.
She's been so awesome in facilitating that. But we need you to actually vote on a poll for the next fellowship opportunity that they're going to do. I know it closes tonight. So she told me, make sure you join the Holy City Life group. If you need help doing that, you can talk to her or talk to somebody here who knows that. But just fill out the poll tonight for the next fellowship opportunity. And then another opportunity that Brian and I will be at, we're actually really excited, this coming Monday, Lord of the Rings, which is like this book or movie.
Yeah. Have you heard of it?
So apparently it's this great movie, and I'm so excited. I've seen it. I'm just messing with you. So we're going to go see it. It's been, what is it, digitally remastered?
Digitally remastered, extended version, special big screen showings, only one night, or possibly two if they extend it. But we're going to go to the Return of the King.
That's going to be
Monday night,
7 p.m. Monday at the Citadel Mall. We literally already bought our tickets, and how many? There were
seven left. So if you want to go with us, sign up quickly.
Get your tickets and let us know if you plan on going, because we'll grab dinner beforehand
yep.
or something like that and talk
yep.
about it. It'll be great. Chances are they might actually have another.
Well, I think they may add another theater itself.
So it might open up. Go ahead and look at the Citadel Mall movie theater and
it's
try to get your tickets.
Glorious.
Feel free to dress up. We're going to dress up as
yes.
Characters. I wonder what we will be. It's going to be great. All right, so what are we talking about tonight?
We are talking about embodiment, which
is fancy
word. It is not related to embalming, someone asked me.
Did it really?
Not that.
I mean, it's
not
kind of related. in a weird
it,
way.
Maybe in a sort of a
that's not what we're talking about
tonight. Kind of way. But no, what we're talking about is the fact that part of what makes the Christian faith unique is that it places a very high value on our bodies as being part of who we are, as being made in the image of God. And in addition to that, the Christian faith puts a big emphasis on our being together with other people physically, being in the same place like we are tonight, and that there is value and beauty that is found in that, that is particularly important in a culture that is tending more and more toward isolation and technology and the metaverse instead of embodiment.
Yeah, and there's so many ways that we could kind of come at this. In fact, this topic really touches on a lot of the different things we've talked about in the past. If you didn't know this, we actually have a podcast where we upload all of our talks. You can look up Theology on Tuesdays. I think there's a picture of us here on that. So you can go back and listen to the past ones. But this one kind of brings a lot of those together. And you know, one of the things that I think we have to recognize at the outset is so much has changed in the world recently, but even going back just like 200 years, the average human life looks very different now. And technology has been a major piece of that. There's been a lot of technological advancement. There's been a lot of progress for good, and we want to fully acknowledge that. One of the things that I was hoping that we would talk about tonight is while there's been so much good and so much progress, there have been probably some unintended consequences or maybe side effects from this that most people don't really think about, that maybe aren't, you know, the first thing on your mind. And I think they all are rooted to what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to have a body? And so what are some of the things that, let's start with that, I guess, the advancements, the progress that has been made, what have been some of the things that might be surprising about the way that it actually has had negative consequences for having, like, our relationships, our physical bodies? And
yeah,
well,
there's so many things, and all of these are kind of a double-edged sword, but one of the things that has changed really dramatically is that now people are very, very mobile. So it is very unusual for someone to grow up somewhere and then to spend their life in that place. Maybe a little bit less so in Charleston than in some other places, but we are much more mobile. And along with that has come the idea of not just moving once, but potentially moving many, 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 many times and not living in proximity to family. 200 years ago, that was unknown. The other thing, well, there are probably 100 things that could be on this list, but another one is that's more recent is this whole idea of working remotely. If you had asked people 10 years ago about working remotely, they wouldn't have understood what you were talking about. There used to be a thing called working at home that you used to occasionally get to do one or two days if you had some reason to do that. But if you were working for a company, you were working in a place that had a culture and an environment where you were surrounded by people. That's why there's so many sitcoms that are set in offices, because that was the reality if you worked. And we could go on and on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so the whole notion of work, in many ways, just what you brought up, but we could talk the whole rest of the time about how technology and advancement and all that has affected what does it mean to be human. And part of that means, like, we were created to work, and that work is actually a good thing. But even the very nature of the work has changed so much. You mentioned, you know, just the mobility. That I don't think we can overstate just how significant the invention of, like, the steam engine was. I mean, for the most part, if you, in the early 1800s or something, maybe, I don't even know when that was, I guess, but leaving, let's say, England, going over to, you're laughing at me because I don't know my facts.
I'm envisioning the steam engine on the railroad taking you from the United States to England, and that's not going to work.
When was that? I was thinking like the Titanic, Brian.
That wasn't going to work either, Justin.
To go from England to the United States?
It sank.
I never got to the end of the movie. All right. Anyways, so what I was talking about was, like, you were pretty much, if you were going to leave a place like that, you said goodbye to your relationships there.
Right.
Now that's
over.
I mean, you can get to the other end of the world in a day, or less than that. I mean, I just got back from Germany. I was gone. And the whole notion of jet lag is one of those surprising things. Like, wow, that's incredible, the fact that we can do that. But, like, one of the small things that we take for granted is, like, man, it takes actually a while. My body recognizes this isn't
maybe it wasn't designed
to actually go across time zones in a day. And I think that's one of the small, subtle ways that we're used to, like, or I guess not used to thinking about how technology has changed us, but certainly relationally, in terms of work, all of these things have pretty significant, I mean, smartphones we haven't even talked about now, but the mobility, all of that, we had, in many ways, proximity, the ability to have some sort of point of contact and connection, but our relationships in many ways have suffered, because obviously the loneliness, what is it, epidemic, pandemic, I'm not sure which one it is.
Both.
It's both of them. In terms of loneliness and relational suffering, in spite of all of the advancements, if you ask the person today, are you happy, compared to somebody, you know, just 50 years ago, it's a dramatic difference, I guess.
Well, and part of it, too, is that it used to be that there was a whole web of relationships of daily life, that every part of your life involved interacting with other human beings. So things like going to the grocery store, there were people that worked in the grocery store who could help you, and then when you had to check out, there was a person at the cash register that you had to go through in order to be able to leave the store. But now, you know, everything has changed. It used to be like when you went to the gas station when I was really little, somebody came out to your car and you talked to them and they would pump your gas and then you would pay them. And slowly but surely, all of these sort of little interactions with other human beings were doing away with. And then when the pandemic happened with COVID, we became that much more isolated. And one of the things that's happened is that we've had this massive shift in relationships, first with what I was talking about, is sort of the daily interactions with lots of different people, that has been greatly curtailed. But the other thing is friendships. Friendships have changed really dramatically and not in a good way. And most of you probably know that your generation, statistically, is the most anxious and most lonely generation on record, despite the fact that you are the most connected generation in terms of being able to be wired in with a lot of people. You might have 1,000 friends on Facebook, or you might have 1,000 followers on Instagram, but in terms of actual friendships, those are really rare now. And so much of that comes from the fact that people are not together. So when you're not in proximity, when you're not together, it fundamentally shifts what the relationship is like. And you just think about, in the Christian scriptures, when you read about Jesus and his disciples, he called these men to follow him. Well, that implies proximity. And then Jesus and those 12 disciples lived together 24/7 for 3 years. That is embodiment. Mm-hmm. That is not what we think of as a Facebook friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned earlier about just, in many ways, your generation being able to do things that every other generation we take for granted now, but would have absolutely unprecedented. The ability to travel, the ability to do a number of things, to be connected, and yet the suffering and the relationships. I was talking actually just to somebody before we started tonight, and I was already going to talk about this, but the reality that you can do all of these good things. You can actually travel to any number of places in a car, right? Just on the weekend. You can, more people going to good things, right? Like weddings or social things or whatever it is. All of that's good and a good thing. But when you all of a sudden have the ability to do so much more than what most people could, now you're forced to actually say no in ways that other generations didn't have to say no. And I think now what was a given before is actually an impetus on your generation of, just because we have the technology to do something doesn't mean that it's actually the best for us, especially in terms of relationships. If you think about, you have the quote from C.S. Lewis, but like the notion of just being able to do and go anywhere at a whim is wonderful, especially in your 20s. Even as a parent now, I would love to do that. But some of those things, jobs, families, they actually root you in some ways. But the danger is you can actually kind of cut off the limb that you're sitting on when you go off in all of these good directions. And what you really want is friendship, but the demands of it is embodiment. You must be present as much. I just don't know any relationship that started online. I remember doing college ministry, and when all the college students left campus and I was trying to do evangelism virtually, I was like, no, I'm not doing that, because that'd be just really weird for everybody. If you're trying to meet people online and then tell them about Jesus and build a relationship, you can't build a relationship when you're not actually present
together,
and it doesn't last. And even those who do have a relationship in a season because they were together, after seasons apart, being in different parts of the country, let's say, it's still really important to get together regularly, at least once a year or something like that, to maintain that relationship,
right?
Because it doesn't work. But I love the Lewis quote that you're talking about
his advice. This is a profoundly countercultural quotation from C.S. Lewis, and he says, "Friendship is the greatest of worldly goods. Certainly to me, it is the chief happiness of life. If I had to give a piece of advice to a young man about a place to live, I think I should say sacrifice almost everything to live where you can be near your friends." Now, that is not something that you ever heard from your career counselor or placement person in college or grad school or any of that. We are taught that the only thing that you want to maximize is your economic earnings potential, and that wherever you can maximize that, that is where you should go. But we've lost sight of, I don't know how many of y'all ever took a class in economics, but in economics there's a concept called opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. And opportunity cost means that when you choose one thing, you are, by the fact of doing that, choosing it against something else. And what we've lost sight of is that all these things that we embrace, they have an opportunity cost. And it's not an accident that many people experience their first really bad bouts of dealing with loneliness and anxiety when they come out of college, because they're used to being in a community where they're surrounded by people, where they have a lot of shared experiences and shared time together, and suddenly they're living alone in an apartment in a city where they don't know anyone. And that is a recipe for a lot of stress.
You can be around a lot of people, but it's more than just being around them.
Yes.
You actually need to have that connection.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think, so the world, I don't think actually gets the real problem. Like, it thinks of our identity as mainly who we are is what we are on the inside. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are kind of incidental. They don't really...
It's like all interior.
Yeah. Yep. Our bodies are really... We can kind of do with them what we want because who we really are is on the inside. And the Christian faith both, I think, diagnoses the problem accurately, saying, actually, that's a wrong view of what it means to be human. It's a wrong view of the body. And it also gives the solution in a far more compelling, in a way I think that all of us intuitively know that's a better way to live. So I think we should talk a little bit about that, like what the Christian faith says about what the real problem is and what the solution is to the world around us. And particularly when it comes to the body, what would you say to somebody who's like, well, what does the Christian faith have to say about our bodies?
Yeah, so there, that could be a whole evening. But some basics, Psalm 139 is a great place that talks about our being made in the image of God and being fearfully and wonderfully made, that our bodies, whatever our bodies are like, are made in the image of God. And it's not just the bodies that would be those of an Instagram influencer with a million followers for fitness. It's however we are in the image of God, and that is beautiful and that is good. And then we see that God himself in Jesus Christ chooses to take on flesh, to become incarnate, to become in a body. And there are a lot of ways that God could have communicated with the world other than doing that. But he chose to take on a body, to take on our flesh. And you see in Scripture this whole idea that the body is a temple of the Lord that can be used to worship God, and that all of our senses, sight and hearing and smell and touch and all of those things, God has given all of those to us that we might experience his creation and take our part in it. And all of that is profoundly embodied. It's not some esoteric mental exercise. It's something that you have to be aware to feel the sun on your skin, or to feel the breeze blowing through your hair, or to smell the scent of a candle, or bacon frying in the morning. You know, you have to have a body for those things. And that body and that embodiment is profoundly good. And there's a reason that it's interesting, there's so much psychological research about the benefits of human touch. And one of the things that has happened in our culture is we have gotten to a point where we think all touch must be sexual. And that is profoundly contrary to what Scripture says. And the whole idea of touch is really important, and that Jesus uses touch when he heals people. He could have just, you know, smacked them from a distance and said, "Be healed."
Or just spoken it. He didn't have to touch at all.
He didn't have to touch them at all, but he would touch people like lepers who couldn't be touched, because he knew how important that gift of touch was.
One of the things, so being made in the image of God, and the fact that because of that, our bodies are inherently good. But even more than that, I think this is really important. Who we are, it's not so much that we have a body, we are a body.
Yes.
We are embodied souls, or ensouled bodies.
Yep.
Like, and that's, we're both body and soul equally. That's our identity.
Mm-hmm.
And our body is integrally connected and rooted in who we are. And
yes.
I think that's the diagnosis that's wrong, I think, with the world doesn't believe that. And though our bodies were created good, they are also affected by the fall. The fact that we decay is the effect of sin. The wages of sin is death. We are in, our bodies are affected with that. That's why we die. But the good news of the Christian faith is even our bodies will be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what eternity is, an embodied existence,
yes,
right?
That we will have a resurrection body.
Yeah.
This is another place where the Chronicles of Narnia are so great, because Lewis does such a beautiful job of portraying how our old, feeble, decrepit bodies at the end of life will be renewed and become beautiful and young and strong again in that resurrection body.
Yeah. And I think that the solution, I mean, you already touched on, like, the fact that the Christian faith offers the solution that we know we all actually long for, which is, in some sense, like, not just ethereal embrace, but even a physical embrace, both by God and others to an appropriate degree. And you see that one of the things we were talking about before was the number of times that Paul in the New Testament commands to greet one another with a holy kiss. Anybody happen to know the number of times Paul commands to do that? Almost half of his letters, five times.
Yep.
Now, that was a culturally appropriate thing back in 2,000 years ago, where that wouldn't have been risque. But the main, I think the applicable principle is there is a physical sign of appropriate affection extended, that it's not just disembodied, but an embodied greeting. And it's one of the things that, in many ways, the church is the solution to our world that is hungry for embodiment, that's hungry for real relationship. Because the church is not a building, it's a people, it's relationships. And anybody know Jesus said the greatest commandment. Anybody happen to know the greatest commandment? Okay, go ahead. I hope you know it.
Y'all all know this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself.
Right. And I think so often we think of that, particularly that last part, love God, love your neighbor. We tend to think that means love God and love everybody. But that's not actually what Jesus said. Your neighbor is an embodied person. It's a tangible, physical person. You know, the fact that we have bodies means we have limits. It means we can't be in all places at all times, unlike God. And so our neighbor is whoever we come across.
Yes.
An embodied person. And actually, in the church, we are encountering all sorts of neighbors that we're intended. I mean, we pass the peace. we are meant to be in deep relationship with real physical people in front of us.
Yeah, and part of the whole deal with the command, greet one another with a holy kiss, is that when you come into relationship with Jesus, you come into a new family, and you come into this bondedness with people that you belong to, and they belong to you. And so this is the family greeting, if you will, to greet one another with a holy kiss, in a way that shows intimacy and love. And one of the things that Justin and I were talking about earlier today is how we have moved so far away from that idea of healthy touch in our culture. And many of you, if you've studied about infant well-being, you may remember that there was a movement in Europe in the 19th century to remove childbirth from the home and to put it into hospitals, because hospitals could be germ-free and sanitary and all of that. And so in Vienna, they had some of the earliest hospitals that were really very clean. They made sure there were no bacteria, everything was great. And so mothers would go there to have their babies. And what they found is that the infant mortality rate went up. And the reason that that happened is the babies were separated almost immediately upon birth. And what they learned is that if those babies were held, it didn't even have to be by the mother. If the babies were held, they thrived. We are created in such a way that we need touch. There's some really interesting research about anxiety and hugs, that if you are like really upset and anxious, if you are hugged by somebody that loves you for more than 15 seconds, all of a sudden your anxiety level just plummets. So we are hardwired that we need touch, but we have created a culture where that seems to be inappropriate most of the time. So it is kind of a catch-22.
And I think that's why the Christian faith, again, what it does is say, actually, there's a way you can abuse touch. And mm-hmm. it's the Christian faith that says, actually, your bodies are so holy that to abuse and to inappropriately touch people
right.
is wrong.
Is horrific.
Yeah. And at the same time, it says, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You actually need to recognize that touch is important and a gift, and not all of it is sexualized. In fact, one of the books that most impacted me when I was in seminary was written by somebody who, same-sex attracted, he recognized that his longing to be in a relationship with somebody of the same sex sexually was a sin. He couldn't read the scriptures otherwise. And he told his parents, and his parents were like, but you'll never hug anybody. And he that just like blew my mind to think, oh my goodness. And his solution was, well, I sure hope I will hug people.
Yeah.
In reality, where will you do that if it's not the church?
Right.
And we have
right.
to be prepared if we actually, I mean, this issue of sexuality, like for those who seek to live obediently to the biblical sexual ethic, to create a place where you can actually still physically embrace appropriately so that that physical touch, which has the power
that's
to
healthy.
Heal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, all
absolutely.
Of us know that when people have appropriately used touch, there's a way that doesn't, it transcends words, right? I mean, this is why God doesn't just give us a sermon on Sundays. He gives us the sacraments, which
right.
are in many ways his physical sign.
Right, they're sensual.
Of his love.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think one of the other things that relates to all of this is how important it is to make the effort to physically be together with people. It's really easy when you are working and you're tired at the end of the day to just go home and be on screens all night. And part of what I think is so important is to be proactive in taking the initiative to plan things with people. And to do that more in advance, rather than at 6 o'clock on Friday night, texting your 5 closest friends and saying, what are you up to? That is not intentional. Well, it's maybe more intentional than doing nothing, but it's not really intentional. But if you plan to be with people, even if you come home from work and you're tired, if you've committed that you're going to do something, you will go, hopefully. And I would say 99% of the time, you will be really glad that you did that. And I think there's nothing more sad than when you see and Charleston is a great place to observe this, to go to a restaurant and look at the number of people that have planned to be in this restaurant with someone and they are on their phone. I mean, it's just so sad that there's this amazing person sitting there created in the image of God on the other side of the table from you, and you aren't even interested enough to try to ask questions and explore who that person is. And if you want to have real connectedness with people, you have to plan to actually be with them.
I think we also need to recognize the addictive nature of, I mean, there's no doubt, like, social media or screens that we all, I mean, I'm guilty of this myself, that we're addicted to. Mm-hmm. It's important to schedule it. That's good. Yeah. What else would you say, and maybe we'll give you the last word on this and we'll go open to questions, but somebody who's like, that sounds great, but I still just struggle day to day to do that. And all right, if I'll schedule it, but even when I'm there, I feel that urge, the nudge to always grab my phone, or I just don't know how to ask good questions. What counsel would you give to folks like that?
Yeah, that's great. I would say one thing that's a great thing to do is to, if you're with friends, to agree that you're going to put your phones in a basket, or you can put them in the middle of the table and silence them and just agree you're going to not look at them, because if you've got them surreptitiously in your pocket, you're gonna be messing with them. So I think getting the phone off limits, that is a great first step. And then the next thing is to think about, in terms of asking questions, part of what is hard when you live in a culture where media is telling you to be self-centered all the time, it's not natural to think about what's going on in someone else's life. So you have to train yourself to do that. And you can start with really easy things like, how was your day? That's not a very risky thing. But where you really are going to get traction in terms of building a friendship is, tell me about the time that you most recently experienced real joy. Or tell me about something that was a challenge in your life that you felt like you overcame. Or, you know, maybe less risky things, what was your favorite place that you've ever visited on a vacation and why? Who is your favorite author? Why? What movie did you really love? What music do you really love? Asking someone else those kinds of questions will begin to draw out that person. And that's where you begin to find areas where you connect. And C.S. Lewis, again, who's written a lot about friendship that is really worth reading, one of the things he said is that friendship really begins when you are with another person and you see that when you mention something, the other person says, what, you too? And they actually are interested in the same thing that you are. And he says, when two friends see the same truth, and particularly when it's the truth of the gospel, there's a bond that forms that is really, really significant.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm glad you answered that. A lot of the things that I see for those who grew up with a cell phone, the reality is that disembodied existence that is normal, there's a real experiential reality of when you actually try to engage in embodied ways. So even just call, like, I would call college students when I was doing college ministry, and they would freak out because how do you have a conversation? Like, they,
right,
something was wrong.
Right. Yeah.
And that's one degree, and it's even more so when you're actually in person trying to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's just part of the side effect. So I think growing up where that's the norm is you're just texting or you're on a phone. And so I want to give validity to the experience that a lot of young people have where that's just hard. And I
yes.
think that's a teaser.
Yes.
One of the things we've talked about doing is doing either a series of Theology on Tuesdays or some other venue where we could talk about how to actually grow and develop friendships.
Yes. So, yes.
Well, John, how are we doing on questions? Where are you?
He's right there.
Okay, I can't see you.
He's embodied right back there by the bar.
He's disembodied to me, so.
We got a few questions. If you want to take the time to go ahead and like some of these questions or go ahead and submit other questions, please go ahead and do so right now. I'll go ahead and ask the first one. How do you think virtual proximity has affected the dating process? Individuals are no longer limited to those in their quote-unquote village.
I think it can be a blessing and a curse. I think sometimes through sort of the virtual world, you can meet people that share things that are really important to you that you might not have run into otherwise. But I still am a big believer that you are best off with sort of the concentric circles of people that you know in terms of building a relationship. One of the things, that, and this may be just because I'm old, but one of the things that was really interesting when Jane and I started dating and then when we got married and then we're going to all of our friends' weddings is how many people we knew who met someone at a wedding of a friend who ended up getting married to that person. And probably the craziest one of those is my college roommate was a groomsman in our wedding. Jane's college roommate was a bridesmaid in our wedding. They met each other at our wedding and got married to each other. That was very embodied. But I think that with the virtual world, it all depends on how you are approaching that and what you are looking for. So often our culture puts all its emphasis on how someone looks, and that is a very unstable basis for any kind of relationship.
Yeah, I think in addition to that, naming that embodied interaction requires risk and vulnerability.
Yes.
We didn't really talk about that, but I think that's a huge part, especially if you're romantically interested in somebody. You can do anything, you know, how many times people have broken up via text or email instead of like, it takes risk every step of personal contact.
Yes.
Embodied existence is more and more risky because it's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I think you can do anything, you know, again, it can be a great tool to try to meet people, but as quickly as possible, moving to that where all five of your, you know, your senses are actually engaged and you're in real time having to make conversations.
Yes.
Because that's who you really are.
Right.
You're not on, you're not an avatar on the screen.
No, that's exactly
right. And I think, so again, I wouldn't want to just say all technology is bad. In its proper place, it's good, but you have to recognize who you really are is an embodied reality. It's who you are when you wake up in the morning.
Right.
And being able to talk to somebody in the moment. So I think it's important to do that.
What are some ways to work to be closer to others when you feel overwhelmed with work?
That's a great question. I think when you are overwhelmed with work, that is one of the best times to make sure that you plan to do things with people. So if you are, hopefully, even when you are overwhelmed, you know that if you've made a commitment to go and be with a group of people for a particular event, you will not call them and say, I'm sorry, I've just got so much to do, I can't come. I'm gonna assume that you will make the effort, but I think planning to do things with people is part of what's important, and figuring out how to set boundaries on your work. One of the things that is, I think, perhaps the most pernicious aspect of what has happened to work after the pandemic is that many employers have the idea that they own you 24/7 and that no matter what's going on in your life, you have to drop all of it to respond to them. But the fact of the matter is that's a lie. And if you do good work, if you set boundaries and you don't respond to calls or you respond by saying, I am otherwise occupied with this, whatever it might be, I will respond to your email, you know, tomorrow morning, whatever it might be. I think setting those kinds of limits is really important, and actually planning things with people where you are going to be embodied together with people, either for dinner or whatever it might be, and you have that on your calendar and keep that as a commitment. I think that will help a lot.
I really relate to this question. I think having just come off of vacation where I had my out of office email set up,
yep.
I don't know about you, I start sweating, like I'll still see the inbox growing, mm-hmm. and I'm like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That needs, like, I'm going to have to tackle that at some point. I'm going to just look at it. And that's not helpful. Also,
crack cocaine.
It is. Not that I know what that is, but
nor do I.
Firmly agree. But I was so slow in getting one of these. I remember it was like 2012 or so, right when, and my employer was like, why don't you have a smartphone? And I was like, because I don't want my email to follow me home.
Right.
And it was like, eventually, I should have been more resolute in just saying no to that, because part of me wishes that I would have that. Now, I think there's, if people need to get a hold of me, they can call, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think, yeah, that's what's particularly difficult. Texting, we thought that this would make work. The whole reason you have technology is because it makes life easier.
In theory.
Yes. That it makes work more efficient. And all of a sudden, we're doing more and more work than any age in any civilization. And it's not normal. It's not normal to think, but you're just kind of like hardwired and nudged when the notification happens, when you're on vacation, to look at the email, or you know, you've got somebody who texts and you're like, I really don't want to hurt their feelings. It's going to be a week before I respond, or 5 weeks or whatever. Like, it's just, and that takes intentionality to try to manage people's expectations. But this is where we're at. Like, this is the, and I don't think you're going to bottle it up and go back to the way the world was.
Definitely.
You actually have to make the hard decisions to, like, if you don't stand up for yourself, if you don't stand up for your schedule and the priorities, the technology and the world around you is going to force itself.
Right. It's going to be a tsunami.
And I think it's one of the most important things you can do is to actually see that God cares about that. This is why He's commanded a day off of work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most important broken commandments that we probably have is to cease working. And I think that includes, even in the evenings, just being clear about that with what is a healthy rhythm. And I think in many ways, it's just owning kind of where you are, what your tendencies are. Mm-hmm. The way I first heard this question was people that you work with, if you're so focused on your work that you miss them in relationships.
Right. Yep.
And that's where I'd say surround yourself with people who are not task-oriented and who are more people-oriented.
Yes.
And I've found that to be helpful.
Yes.
So, but anyways,
we are very blessed that we have each other in our work environment.
There we go.
So that's a good thing. Yes.
What else?
How do you respond to new Christians who are unwilling to physically attend a church? How do you convince them that church is not just a building?
Oh, boy, that's such a great question. I would say one of the things that is really important when you come to the Christian faith is that presumably most people that come to the Christian faith believe that the scriptures are God's word. And when you look in the scriptures and you look at the early church and you look at Jesus and his disciples, there is no such thing as someone who comes to the Christian faith without coming to the church. It does not exist in the Bible or the New Testament. When you are converted to Christianity, you come into a new family and you are with those people. That is absolutely the way it is all through the New Testament. And to say that you can be an sort of the Lone Ranger Christian on your own is as heretical as any of the heresies that plagued the early church. It is something that is, I think, peculiarly American in some ways, because we have a strong independent streak, and we think, well, I prayed the prayer, I accepted Jesus, I don't need anybody else, it's me and Jesus against the world. That's an idea, but that is not a Christian idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really important. Like, what is the Christian message that they believed? And if it's a truncated message that's basically, look to Jesus, he'll forgive your sins, that's true, but the whole story is that he saves you for what?
Right.
And that's an embodied existence in a family of faith with actual people, both Old and New Testament, in heaven for all eternity.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, what I would say to the question is have compassion, recognize where they are, go meet with them, see if they'd be open to reading the Bible together. And the more you actually read the Bible, I defy you to find any place in the Bible where it talks about the church as a building.
Right.
You will see in the Bible that the church, the gathered people of God,
it's a body of believers.
It's a body of believers, yeah. And that's really important. And that's what we didn't talk about this at all. But the saddest thing about COVID for me was it makes you schizophrenic in person. So people are okay. Like, again, we are. I would have never in a million years thought that we'd be like filming and people would actually watch like an Anglican service. That's just weird to me. But people apparently do. And there's some good to that. I don't want to deny that.
Yeah.
But again, it downplays what the actual Christian message is because it makes you schizophrenic. It says, all right, your eyes and your ears, if you're able to like not focus on all the stuff around you, like the noise in your house, or if you can actually look at the screen, you can, with your eyes and your ears, see the church service going on. But your taste, your smell, your touch is in your pajamas, smelling the bacon, feeling the couch, you know, and that's that's a schizophrenic experience of what worship is meant to be, which is holistic and in community. And so I'd say have patience, but recognize and read the scriptures together, and eventually it's ultimately God, the Holy Spirit, who convinces people what is the truth.
Yep.
And I have hope with that he will actually lead you into the truth together.
Yes. And I would say the other thing about that is that particularly in the Bible Belt, we have this idea about going to church, that it's like a box that you check on Sunday morning. That is not what it means to be part of a church. It's much more than, you know, checking a box of showing up on Sunday morning. That's important that you show up on Sunday morning, but not to check the box, but to be able to engage with the family of God that's in that place, and to turn your eyes toward Jesus to worship God. These are very good questions.
Yeah, that's a good question. John?
Sorry.
You're disembodied.
I lost my place. How do we deal with the anxiety surrounding what Brian was speaking of, the quote-unquote opportunity cost?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I think recognizing first and foremost that the more opportunities you have, the more anxious you're going to be. Mm-hmm. And so you can't get around it. You have to face it head on. And secondly, I would say when you look at what the scriptures teach, that you can't be everything, you can't do everything. You weren't created to do that.
Yep.
And that is actually still a really good existence.
Limitations are beautiful.
That God wants you to have. That you will... you know, the image that I always kind of envision of this is like trying to work 24/7 all year round is like running into a wall and hoping that it doesn't hurt your body. But eventually, that's just what happens, right? So like if you recognize you can't be infinite, you can't do everything, which by the way, every culture, that's part of what sin is that we actually think we can be the master of the world, we can do whatever we want. It's just our culture now has more choices probably than any other culture in what we can actually do. And so again, I go back to saying you have to stick up for yourself and not expect anyone else to actually do that. If you're a good friend, you might ask good questions and try to hold people accountable that actually invite you to do that. So having a group of people together who are trying to live according to their limitations that God designed. So not working 7 days a week, recognizing, wow, I haven't been in Bible study for a month now. I haven't been to church in person in a while. To actually have relationships where you can ask the question together, I think the only way to get around the anxiety behind it is to have the fellowship and relationships of people where you're safe, you're secure, you're welcomed, you know that you're not living perfectly, but you're called to trust God more and more and to seek to follow Him, and you're on that path together. And so if you're in relationships with people where you can actually do that together and call one another to further faithfulness, that's going to help with the anxiety of that constant being expected to do all these other things. But it's just a countercultural way of thinking.
Yeah.
You have to, I think, approach it that way.
And I think part of that, too, is realizing that you've been sold a lie. Because I think that for most people that went to a reasonably good high school, you have been told you can do it all. you can have it all. You can be on the sports team, you can be on the honor roll, you can be the lead in the school play. You can do all of these things, and you should. You need to maximize. And the problem is that is a lie. And the more that you try to carry that sort of mentality forward as you get older, you will burn yourself out because you just can't do it all. Mm-hmm. And so part of what you have to do is to choose wisely what you're going to be actually invested in. And if that's something where you feel really overwhelmed, finding someone who is maybe a little bit older who loves you, who can help you sort through those sorts of things, that can be very helpful. But to push back against the cultural pressure, then you can do all of it because you can't.
And I think part of the lie is that we were talking about this earlier, that you're planning for the future. And so there's always the promise that I have to sacrifice this now, I have to live this way now, but in a year, in 2 years, in five
right.
years, it'll be worth it.
Which is a lie.
And it's a lie.
Yes.
And because it actually only builds,
yes.
right? It just gets more and more. So unfortunately, but I think realizing, oh, wait a minute. It's just only going to have more options and more things begging for my
yes.
time in 2, 5, 10 years down the line.
Yeah.
Can y'all speak on the importance of spending time with others and balancing spending quiet time alone with the Lord?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. There's a wonderful book by Dietrich Bonhoeffer that's called Life Together. And one of the things, Dietrich Bonhoeffer lived in Germany during World War II and was one of the people who was opposed to Hitler, and he was put into a concentration camp and ultimately executed there. But Life Together is all about the importance of Christian community. And he says, let him who cannot be in community beware of being alone, and let him who cannot be alone beware of being in community. And what he means by that, I think, is that both of those things are really important. So you've got to put a stake in the ground. The first stake in the ground is your time in the Word of God and in prayer. That is sort of the bedrock of your spiritual life. And one of the things that does is it enables you to have a perspective and something to give when you come into relationship with other people. If you are relying on other people for your spiritual welfare, that is eventually going to cause you to burn out, because you have to be feeding on the Word of God and being renewed by the Holy Spirit. But there's a balance in there, because if you spend all of your time just alone with God and you're not with His people, you are outside of His will.
I think looking at Jesus, who did this perfectly, obviously, right? So He disappointed people by going to spend time alone. He actually didn't heal everybody. He would leave towns and go away at their great disappointment.
Yep. Yep.
He would take time alone. And yet He also was very intentional about being with others. And I think recognizing for each of us, we have a disposition in one of those directions.
Mm-hmm.
And being aware of that can be really helpful, so that you can recognize, all right, I may invite somebody to try to help hold me accountable, or to continue to try to mitigate my natural tendency, which is to go in one of those directions and to seek to have a balance that we see in Jesus. So. Well, that was fun. I feel like we did okay with, I mean, a topic that could have been the entire year's
yes.
worth of stuff. So thank you guys for coming out tonight. Remember, on Monday, we're going to the movies to see Lord of the Rings. It'll be fine just if you and I dress up as hobbits together and nobody else shows up.
It's gonna be
great. That's fine. But if you want to come see the Lord of the Rings, talk to us. We'll be there. It'll be a lot of fun.
Yep.
7 p.m. Monday. Thanks for coming out, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming.